You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the 1980s, Daryl Strawberry was to professional baseball what Michael Jackson was to pop music, prodigiously gifted and at the top of his game. During his 17-year career in Major League Baseball, Daryl was a key member of the Mets team that won the World Series in 1986, played for the Yankees in three World Series. But Mr. Strawberry is not just famous for being a star athlete. His drug habits and marital problems also made headlines. However, he has been clean for several years, and in 2008, Daryl Strawberry joined Sportsnet New York as an anchor for the Mets' pre- and post-game shows, and now he's written a memoir in collaboration with John Strasberg called Straw Finding My Way. It's published by Echo, and I'm pleased that it brings Daryl Strawberry to the show today. Hello.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Aren't you living in Missouri these days? At least that's what the book says.
Yes, I am living in beautiful St. Louis, where it's quite different, you know, quite different from New York, quite different from Florida and California.
Culture shock.
Culture shock when I first went there.
Because you grew up in L.A., and then you spent so much time here in New York.
Yes, I also spent a lot of time in Florida, too. So going to Missouri was definitely a new start and a new breed of life, and it's been wonderful. I've really enjoyed the people in St. Louis and just the home down-to-earth people in the Midwest.
Well, didn't you say good riddance to New York when you joined the Dodgers? Although you also say that it was the saddest day in your life when you left the Mets?
No question. It was the saddest day leaving New York. I got so accustomed to, you know, what New York was all about, New York fans and playing in this atmosphere. And, you know, I thought it was a great move to leave at that particular time to go home and play at home in California.
You saw that as your comfort zone?
I thought it would be a comfort zone, but when I realized it and I got out there, it wasn't New York. You know, I was so accustomed to, you know, what the atmosphere was like in New York, the fans, and what baseball was and what sports meant in New York. L.A. was a little different, you know. It was more laid back. You know, they come late and leave early. New York fans don't come late and they don't leave early.
What about expectations? Because when a star moves to another team, it's assumed that he's going to be a savior. The Dodgers were struggling in those days.
No question. I think the expectations were great. But I've always was prepared for expectations. You know, I lived through that, you know, playing my first 8 years here, the expectations. And, you know, I went out and, you know, played as well as I could and gave my best every night I put on the uniform. So the expectations were always great, but I really never concerned myself. I was more concerned about the atmosphere. I was used to when you didn't play well, New Yorkers are going to let you know. And that was a great thing for me because it was kind of a booster for me to energize myself even more to go out there and want to play well. But L.A., it was different. They didn't do that. You know, they kind of just like, oh, if you don't play well, then so be it.
I'm not sure. Some athletes, I guess, like that. They feel pressured here in New York. You did return to play for the Yankees. Talk about pressure.
Well, it was a different time. You know, I was older and I had experienced some things in life, and it was a different time, and it was another challenge. I think the greatest thing about that, it was a challenge for me because the sports writers had written me off and said I couldn't. He couldn't play no more. Yankees didn't need him. But the boss, George, thought, you know, he wanted me to be a part of his Yankee teams.
Was part of the problem the expectation based on just the natural skills that you had? You looked like Ted Williams when you came up to bat. You had that wonderful swing. Everybody just assumed that you could get a hit every time, or at least bat 400 the way Ted Williams did in 1 year of his career.
Well, expectations is, I always wonder where do they come from? Who expectations? Is it from the opinions of sports writers, you know, that write about a particular person? What is expectations? You know, that's what I've always looked at it as. It's hard enough to play the game. It's more difficult than it seems to be just because you're gifted. It doesn't really mean that you're going to excel, because there's been a lot of great gifted athletes that never achieved and excelled to that point.
And then there are other athletes who don't have all the gifts who do very well.
Who do very well. Those that don't have all the gifts do very well because there's no pressure to perform. You know, it's just nobody's expecting them to, you know, really be this superstar, that someone that can actually carry a team, put a team on his back and carry a team. So, you know, sports is so hard, you know, and as a kid, when you're learning to play it, you know, I always try to tell parents, allow your kid to have fun, because if he doesn't have fun, and you force him into it, and you push him in, put him in a situation, he's not going to be able to enjoy himself, and that's what it really all boils down to.
But you didn't begin thinking of yourself as a baseball player. You're going to play basketball?
No, yeah, I thought about playing basketball. I love playing basketball. I started really developing into basketball when I was in high school, and I realized, hey, this is fun, you know. Especially I was tall, and then I was, you know, turning out to be pretty good as a basketball player. But in the back of my mind, I always knew baseball was my sport. I always knew I had it, you know. Then I just knew I had it in baseball, what it takes to play, because the competition was a little bit different. It's that one-on-one, you against the pitcher, and that's a real challenge.
And also because your father was an ace softball player, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a softball player. He was a great softball player, and we watched him from time to time, and, you know, I saw his athletic skills, and he was one of the, you know, top players in the softball league for the post office where he worked.
The first chapter begins with a very powerful story involving Big Hank, your father, and a shotgun. What happened on that evening?
Well, that was a very difficult night for us as young kids. You know, I was 13 and brother Ronnie was 14. I believe my brother Michael was 15. And we've heard it many times. My dad coming home and he's a raging alcoholic and loud and, you know, abusing my mom. And we woke up that night and my older brother Michael just came out of nowhere and said, why don't you just get out of here and leave us alone? And then he started making threats to the fact that I will kill all you guys. He pulled out a shotgun and, you know, had the shotgun laying there and saying that, you know, he was going to kill us. And then I remember me and my brother Ronnie, because we had took so many beatings and we were frustrated. Me and Ronnie had nights of where we laid in bed in the room and talked about, you know, actually killing him. We were going to have to kill him one day. And we really believed that. And you're talking about 13, 14-year-olds. And, you know, Ronnie went in and grabbed a knife, and I went in and grabbed a skillet. And we said, nobody's dying. In our mind, nobody's dying here tonight but him. You know, me and Ronnie realized that, you know, we were at that point. And I explained that to people, and I says, you know, everybody look at the fact that I went on to, you know, achieve and be successful and be a Major League Baseball player. But they had no idea. That night could have been a real tragedy. That could have came to an end for us as young men.
And you were in a middle-class family.
Middle-class family. My mom was a hard-working person, and my dad was, but he was never involved in our life. My mom was the only one that participated in our lives as kids. She would come out to our sporting events and cheer us on and stuff. We really never had a father figure that was around that was able to, you know, show us, you know, that's what it was all about.
And then he left for good.
After
was that a relief?
Oh, major relief. But, you know, it was a major relief, but me and Ronnie was scarred so bad. You know, we were totally out of whack, dysfunction inside about life. And, you know, especially Ronnie, he even hit it harder than I did. And I went on to get myself together in school and stuff in high school and got involved in sports activities in high school and participated and became, you know, became a different person at that particular time. But, you know, I always remember that though, even those days and achieving things in high school, I always had this feeling inside about myself that I was really nobody. I just had it. I was just there. I don't care how great I did. It didn't matter. It didn't make sense to me because, you know, I was told I would never amount to nothing.
And you bounce around from high school to high school until the sports took over and gave you some focus?
Well, I think junior high school is where I bounced around. Junior high school is where I got into a lot of trouble. I was angry. And when you're angry as a kid, you act out your behavior, and I acted out a lot. And then I finally got settled in. I went to Crenshaw High, and I finally got settled in at high school and got myself together. And I realized that if I was going to play sports, that means you had to go to class. You got to get good grades, you know, because coaches wasn't allowing you just to play. You wasn't just going to be on the team, you know, because you had talent. They made sure that you went to class and you participated in school and you got grades and you had to bring report cards to the coaches.
My guest is Daryl Strawberry, who's written with the help of John Strasbaugh Straw, Finding My Way. It's published by Echo. And your new father figures, the replacements for your father, were your coaches?
They were coaches, you know, that were in my life. And they were people who played big roles in my life. Coach Mr. Mosley. John Mosley. He was one of my coaches. And he basically used to come to the house and knock on the door looking for me to go to practice. And I used to tell my sisters, I'll tell him I'm not here. He goes, I know he's in there, isn't he? And he's in there sleeping, don't want to get out of bed. And he would come in the house, and he would come in the room, knock on the door, and walk in and say, get up.
And then you had another coach, Brooks Hurst, a white coach in a segregated school.
Yes, Brooks Hurst. We had an all-black school, and Brooks Hurst was a white coach. And
now, this is integrated Los Angeles, but it was an all-black school.
It was an all-black school, yes. But Brooks Hurst was our high school coach, and what a phenomenal coach he was. He was the guy that energized all of us, because we're all African American players, and he energized us, and he taught us baseball. He taught us the fundamentals. I had a run in with him with my first year of high school, and I quit the baseball team, and then I went back my junior year, and we had a remarkable team, and they wrote a great book about that team. Of our Crenshaw team, and Brooks Hurst was our coach. He really made us understand what it was going to take. He saw the talent of the players he had, and he pushed us, and he trained us. He trained us harder than anything ever to excel as a high school team.
And you weren't the only guy who made the major leagues from that team.
No, Chris Brown. Chris Brown was our third baseman when I was a junior. In high school, Chris Brown was a senior. He was our third baseman. He was all everything. He got drafted by the San Francisco Giants. He ended up playing in the big league with the Giants and the Padres, you know, and a couple other teams in his career.
When did scouts and sports writers start taking notice of you as a baseball player?
They started taking notice of me when I was a junior in high school. They didn't know I was a junior that year. They were scouting our team. They saw a bunch of senior players and, you know, four guys got drafted from that team, but they kept asking Coach, well, who's the tall, lanky left? And they said, oh, he's that's Daryl Strawberry. He's a junior. And he goes, what? He's a junior? They couldn't believe I was a junior. And he said, yeah. And they say, and he also played basketball. They said, oh, you got to be kidding me. He played basketball, too? They said, well, let's try to keep him off the basketball court because we don't want him to get hurt or tear up a knee or anything and for him to miss his senior year because it could be a remarkable year for him because they realized that I was a kid with power and speed and could play the outfield and also could pitch.
And how did you develop that batting stance? Was that just something that came naturally to you?
It just came natural. You know, I never switched around or tried different things. I pretty much stuck to one thing, and you know that's what worked in high school, and it worked in going through the minor leagues and also to the major league level.
Because in Japan, for example, they have an ideal swing, and they try to get everybody to swing the same way. It probably helps some players, but it ruins others.
Well, yeah, probably in Japan because they're different style of players. You know, they're the kind of players, you know, more of a use the whole field and like to slap the ball and run. And I think American players are more players that, you know, really stand in there and they like to generate bat speed and drive the ball. And, you know, sometimes, I realize, you know, through the WBC now, you see Japan wins every year because of their style of play in that short series.
And they're doing okay in American baseball.
They do great in American baseball, too, the players that come over here. You don't necessarily have to, it just shows that you don't necessarily have to be a power hitter to make it.
Your brother also was signed to play baseball, but he didn't make it out of the minor leagues.
No, my brother Mike, he was signed with the L.A. Dodgers, and he went through their farm system a couple of years, and no, he didn't make it.
And you were signed by the Mets?
I was signed by the Mets in 1980.
What kind of a bonus did you get?
I got $200,000 that year.
So that wasn't bad at that time.
No, that was great. That was one of the biggest bonuses players were getting at that time when I came out in the 80s.
My guest is Daryl Strawberry. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. His book is Straw, Finding My Way, published by Echo. Later on this hour, a look at how Cornelius Vanderbilt became a business mogul and was named the first American robber baron. And then on this week's Underreported, find out why we panic to the outbreak of certain diseases and not others. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from Purchase College in Westchester with the Purchase Dance Corps Spring Concert, featuring works by Doug Verone, Bella Lewitsky, and a premiere by Luca Vigetti, now through May 3rd, Performing Arts Center at 914-251-6200. Elance.com, where businesses hire and work with programmers, writers, designers, translators, and other specialists as needed. Elance facilitates the entire work process, from hiring to collaboration to payment, online at elance.com.
The next WNYC Board of Trustees meeting will be this afternoon at 3 p.m. at WNYC 160 Varick Street, open to the public. Details at 646-829-4000 or WNYC.org.
Remember the Empire Roller Rink in Brooklyn? How about the Palladium on 14th Street? Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and it broke my heart when they closed. Did it break yours? How about the new Yankee Stadium? Did you like the old Times Square better than the new one? The city is changing fast. Which side of the fence are you on? Let's talk.
Join Rosie Perez Thursday morning, May 7th, in the Green Space for the panel discussion, The Places That Bind. Tickets at wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
We're back with Darryl Strawberry, who is an 8-time All-Star, 4-time World Series champion, National League Rookie of the Year in 1983. He played for the Mets, the Dodgers, the Giants, and the Yankees during his 17-year career. And now he's written a book which he says is not really about baseball, although there's an awful lot of baseball in it. It's called Straw, Finding My Way, written with the help of John Strasbaugh and published by Echo. And I mentioned you were Rookie of the Year. You were 21. You just with the Mets in 1983?
83, yes. I was 21.
And now that I don't know whether that's really too early for that kind of success. I mean, what happens to somebody who's 21 years old and suddenly feels like he's on top of the world?
Well, you know, it really depends on where you're at that age, and I'm talking about far as where I started my career. I started in New York, you know, most
at one of the worst stadiums in the world. Yeah. Shea Stadium. Are you glad to see it go?
Not really, because there's a lot of history there. There's a lot of fun, a lot of memories. But that, at the age of 21, when I started here like that, I didn't come here thinking, you know, the expectations and the marketing here was the way it was, you know, far as what they expect out of you. I thought, you know, coming after that rookie year and winning rookie of the year, but after winning rookie of the year, that meant there was a lot more expectations on me, and, you know, they wanted to see it, and I needed to bring it, and you're young, you're still learning at that time, too. And I always say, if I was in a different place, you know, if I was in a quieter place, maybe going to somewhere like Seattle or somewhere like that to play baseball, you probably only have 2 writers. But in New York, you walk in the clubhouse, you got 50 writers.
Do you think that was a problem for Dwight Gooden, who became your really good friend? He had success at an even younger age.
Yeah, he was 19. And there's no question, you know. And you're talking about 19 years old, and then when you see him was 20 and 21, you know, his picture is all over Manhattan.
It was on the side of a building
on the side of a building, Ninth Avenue. Yes. You know, so I'm quite sure you see that and you look at that and, my gosh, we still have a lot to learn about life. You know, we haven't even really tapped into life. Always, you know, all we actually tapped into was our careers, baseball. I mean, we knew that was a part of what we did.
You've said that you would have taken steroids if they were around in baseball in the 1980s. They were in football already. Weren't baseball players using them?
No. Baseball players was not involved. In the 80s, there was no such thing as steroids being involved. We knew about football players probably were taking it. And I think baseball players probably were thinking, wow, football players are crazy to be taking that. And we didn't have it in our era.
You weren't doing weightlifting the way baseball players do today.
No, we never did. No, we wasn't weightlifting, heavy lifting, squats, and all those things. Baseball was more flexibility. You needed that to be able to do the things that you needed to do on the baseball field. We never got to the point of where we wanted to be power builders and be that strong.
Well, you were hitting enough home runs as it is, weren't you?
Well,
I mean, I guess you could have hit 70 or something like that.
Probably could.
That's what
happened
with McGuire.
I don't think players in our days would have been hitting 70 home runs, because you got to remember the ballparks were bigger. The ballparks today are a lot smaller than what they were compared to the ballparks we played in, like the big St. Louis and the big Astrodome. Those were very big ballparks.
You got married. How many years were you playing with the Mets when you married Lisa?
1 year. I was going into my second year.
Now, why did you get married? According to this book, you didn't really need to have a marriage. You were doing okay.
Well, who knows?
All these women were throwing themselves at you and other members of the team.
It wasn't really all about that from the beginning. You know, I mean, Lisa was my first wife, and she had got pregnant with my oldest son, DJ. And
you have five kids altogether?
I have five kids total. And plus, with my wife's kids, she has three, so we have a total of eight. We have our own little section there. But I just felt like, it was the right thing to do. I made a commitment. She got pregnant. I made a commitment. And I felt like it was the right thing to do is to get married.
Although there were warning signs from the start that this could be a troubled relationship.
Oh, no question about it. It was warning signs. We fought about everything. And, her agenda was a little bit, different than what my agenda of life was about and everything. And then going into it, I knew I was in trouble.
And it made headlines.
Made a lot of headlines. Without a doubt, headlines.
Well, isn't that one of the problems? Not that those things should have occurred, but it's hard to live a life where if you have some problems in a marriage, even if you've really screwed up, that it's going to be plastered all over the newspaper.
It's very difficult for anyone, because problems are problems in marriages. And, everybody in life that take those vows and get married, eventually there are going to be some struggles. It's a normal thing. If someone tell you they don't struggle and my marriage is perfect, they're lying. Because we all know that it doesn't work like that. We wish it worked out that way.
Well, you're here with your third wife today, so you seem to at least be willing to travel with her.
That's the miracle. She's the miracle wife. She's the one that the good Lord brought me. And I'm truly thankful for that, because I realize more than anything, and I just don't say it because she's here. I say it when she's not with me. Behind every man's success, there is a great woman behind him, because she has to encourage him. She has to believe in him. She has to trust him. She has to trust him that he's going to build, the right way. And that's important. And I think sometimes as men, we get so egotistic about, it's about me, me, me. And a true fact is, a good woman makes you who you are. They keep you stable. And that's what my wonderful wife has done. She's been able to keep me stable in life.
Well, the stability has only been fairly recent. You've only been clean for a few years. What, since 2002 or so?
Three. Yes.
So is it because of this marriage, or because you finally were able to find a way to not slip back?
Well, no.
Because they say once you're an addictive personality.
Yeah, well, of course they say that, but it wasn't about that. I think it was about the relationship that you have with somebody that develops with you and grow with you, that makes all the difference in your life. Before, it was wives that I had that loved to shop and loved to spend my money. Loved the Louis Vuittons and the Gucci bags. And here it is. I married a girl from the Midwest, and
she has a Louis Vuitton bag.
She told me, I don't know. Well, if she has anything expensive, it's because I bought it. She will not go out and buy it. I'm going to sit here and tell you right now, she's Midwestern, and I had never in my life experienced nothing like that. I've always had the wives that wanted, brand name stuff and have stacks of Chanel purses sitting up in the closet somewhere that they don't even use. And there it is, people out there starving that would need things like that, but they wouldn't give it to anybody. This one here, she's a God-centered woman. She does charity work. She gives back. She helps women. She does all the things that, a man needs and a man looks for.
And you started your own charity, haven't you?
Well, yes, I have. I have. I have a foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit organization that me and my wife started in 06. We walked into the center. Her sister's a special ed teacher for children for autism. And we walked into the center because her sister asked me, would I come visit the kids one day? And I said, sure. And we walked into the center, and she says, be careful. You know, the kids are, you know, high risk, and, you know, they can hit you and hurt you. I says, no, they can't hurt me much as the New York Press hurt me. And I said, I'm not worried about it. And after I walked out of there, I was, like, blown away. It blew me away because we have 8 children together, and none are affected. And I never knew what autism was, and it just blew me away. I came out of there with chills, and I said, Trace, we need to do something. And we went into action, me and her. We sat at home. She sat at home and read up all the paper and the paperwork to start a foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. She did it herself, smart as ever. Did it, put the paperwork together, started a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we went to work. And our goal was to start raising money for the Center for Children that are Affected with Autism.
My guest is Daryl Strawberry. His book, Straw, Finding My Way, written with John Strasberg. So we have two straws here in a way. It is published by Echo. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But you say during the 1986 season, your way of unwinding was drinking, drugging, gambling, and fornicating. We were the kings of New York and treated like royalty at any bar, nightclub. We're about as far as human males could get from being clean-cut all-American heroes. Now, does that affect the performance on the field as well?
Of course it does. But, you know, that's why we probably didn't win as more championships as we should have.
You think it would have been different if you had been playing for the Cardinals?
Of course. I think it would have been a lot different. But we were in New York. We were wild. We were animals. Everybody hated us. We loved it. I don't even get into some of the stories of the nightlife of our traveling and the bus rides, you know, from cities after we get flying from one city to the next city. We're getting in like 4 a.m. and we're hammered and we're all acting crazy and we got to play a game tomorrow. But it was like when we showed up to play the next day, we were ready. You know, it was the most remarkable thing. I put it like this. At that point, we wasn't choir boys. You know, we wasn't saying good night to each other, and we wasn't drinking milk. I think, like, Frank Cash and the general manager wanted us to be milk drinkers. And
he really said to you guys, no, start drinking milk?
No, we believed that's what he wanted, us to be a bunch of milk drinkers, but it was impossible. We were like an animal house, you know. It was just, you know, we were just all over the place, and when it came to we were together. You know, when it came to us in some kind of trouble, you wasn't going to hear about one. You was going to hear about 5 or 6 of us, you know, in a bar that got into trouble or protecting our teammates.
And what happened? Do you think your teammates will be upset by what you've written here?
No, because it doesn't personally point anybody out. I love those guys. You know, I play with them. I wouldn't write a book about, you know, my life and them and start, you know, start telling, you know, who was involved in everything.
Of course, temptations are also thrown at you. I'm not saying that you shouldn't resist, but when people come to you with drugs or the women made themselves available to you, it's, especially if you're a kid, it's kind of hard to resist, isn't it?
Well, it was fun. I mean, you know, come on, let's be honest. You know, I like to be honest about these things and be real about them. And who am I kidding? You know, I'm no different than the average man that walks into a club and want to have a good time and see a beautiful woman and there's a party going on and he's going to tell you he doesn't want to participate in it. That's not true.
1986 was the year that the Mets won the World Series, beat the Red Sox, but it was also the year that you say you became a stone speed freak.
Well, yeah, that's when I took.
That's grief. when the serious drug problem really started.
No, that's not when the serious. I mean, back in those years of '80s, you know, I started taking speed, and I mean, greenies, amphetamines, to play. You know, I became addicted to them, and you know, it was a part of what I had to do to continue to, you know, go out there and perform like I was performing.
What kind of relationship did you have with your teammates?
I had a great relationship with my teammates. I think it was blown out of proportion because I got into, you know, altercations. And, hey, you live
you
together.
You always had a fight with Keith Hernandez.
Well, I did. You know,
now you're on the same team.
Network. But we never had, it was never personal, you know, personal thing. You know, it was just the heat of a moment, you know. I mean, it's just like you live when you're playing baseball, you're living together for like 7 months It's a 7 month. It's going to be a 7 month love and hate affair. You know, you're going to have some altercations and you're going to have some disagreements. But I tell you one thing: when we stepped out on that field as a group, it was on. You know, it didn't matter. You know, we wore the same uniform. We didn't take out our frustration on each other. We took it out on the other team when we went out to perform.
I've always wondered about that. 25 guys coming from very different kinds of backgrounds, sometimes speaking different languages, different personalities, probably don't like some of the other guys. And yet, when you're out there, you just have to act as though you all love each other.
It's part of it. I mean, but we do. I mean, in those days in the 80s, those Met teams, we loved each other. You know, and that group of guys were for real about each other.
When you were with the Yankees, your mother died of breast cancer.
Yes.
And then the team told you that they had no plans to bring you back.
Yes.
That was pretty much the end? You must have been depressed about your mother dying.
I was more concerned about my mother passing than baseball. I didn't care if I ever put on a uniform again. Because after my mother passed, I laid in the bed for 2 weeks without eating. And I was just sick. I was totally sick. I didn't want to go on. I said, forget it.
And then you've had your own cancer problems.
Twice. 98, colon cancer was the first time.
And that was just cut out?
Yes, and then it reoccurred in 2000. And I had to have another surgery, and they removed my left kidney in my second surgery. So I've had some battles.
They usually say 5 years, and you're pretty much clear.
5 years. I'm 9 years now.
Met fans have criticized Citi Field for not having enough tributes to Mets history. Dwight Gooden autographed a wall, and then until the fans complain, the Mets are going to take it off. Now they've moved it to a more prominent place. But do you wonder about that?
Well, I think Mets fans are wondering about that, and they have every right to wonder about that because my whole point is the Wilpons, I believe they will do something. I believe they first step was, you know, getting a new stadium and then opening a new stadium and then completing the new stadium. I think, you know, with the Met fans screaming about the history of, you know, 69 and 86, I think they want that history around there. That's their life. They rightfully so should have that because that's what they lived through. A lot of them have been able to live through. And I think right now they're very frustrated because of what has happened to the team in the last couple of years at the last day of the season, losing out and getting into the playoffs. And it's been a lot of frustration for them.
This year is different. They're folding earlier.
Well, I'd rather for them to fold right now in April, you know, then wait to September. I believe in this ball club. You know, I spent time with them. They got a great group of guys, and I believe that they're going to. I believe they're going to get it together. Right now, they've had a rough start. A rough start could, you know, really turn out to be a real positive thing for them this year. Because all the other times they played well along the road, and then they hit the last end and didn't play well. So, you know, hopefully they get all the headaches out of the way, because that's what they really are, headaches for the fans, because the press is going to continue to rip them until they start playing better.
Just one more thing. Citi Field is not a hitter's park. It's pretty...
Who said that?
Pretty far down each of the lines. It would have been a hard... You know, there are balls that are caught in the outfield that would have been home runs in other...
I think they're thinking too much. People are thinking too much. It's not a hitter's ballpark. It's April. The ball is not carrying as well as it will. May, June, July. When it gets hot, the ball will start flying out of there probably. You know, give it time. You can't judge a ballpark by the beginning of what's happening. And I think that fans need not to worry about that. I think guys need to. I as a hitter, I would never worry about it. I don't care how far the fence is. If you're a home run hitter, you're going to hit home runs. And that's what you have to focus on. You can't focus on the dimensions of the field.
Considering how good the food is, you might have put on some weight if you've been playing in Citi Field. It's Daryl Strawberry's book, Straw, Finding My Way, written with John Strasbaugh. It's Strasbaugh?
Strasbaugh.
Strasbaugh, published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me, guys. I appreciate your time, too.